You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear our first live conversation since joining WBTV. Today I am speaking with Vermont author Bill Schubart, whose new book is Lila and Theron, out this week from a new press, Charles Michael Publishing. Hi, Bill.
How are you?
I'm very well. We're really glad to have you here. I'm going to just read your bio real quick, and then we'll get into a conversation about your wonderful new novel, Lila and Theron. Bill has a very long and impressive bio, but I'm just going to mention some highlights. First and foremost, he has lived with his family in Vermont since 1947. He writes about Vermont in fiction, humor, and opinion pieces. He is the author of several books, The Lamoille Stories, Fat People, Panhead, I Am Baby, Photographic Memory, The Lamoille Stories 2, and the new one, Lila and Theron, which launches tomorrow. He's also a founder of Resolution, Inc. In 1973, he co-founded Philo Records. He also founded the Pleiades Music Group. At the age of 26, Bill Schubart was elected chairman of the Board of Trustees for the Vermont Arts Council, the state's arts agency, and he was the youngest trustee ever to serve as chairman. He has worked with VPR, with the Vermont Symphony Orchestra, the Vermont Folklife Center, the hospital, and many, many other Vermont organizations. Bill has done a lot of good work for Vermont, and he continues to do so. If you listen to Vermont Public Radio, you've heard his wonderful commentaries. Bill Schubart's interests include poetry, photography, stone gardening, which is cool. I totally would love to talk about that. Food preparation, classical and primitive music. He lives in Hinesburg, Vermont, with his wife, Catherine, who's also a writer. He has three sons, Bill, Peter, and Stephen, and a daughter, Anna, as well as a stepson, Guy, and a stepdaughter, Phoebe. I'm going to give a little information about Lila and Theron. Set in rural America and spanning much of the 20th century, the book captures the spirit of the American experience. A young mother dies, giving birth to a son, who is then fostered out. When the boy, Theron, first meets his father and is told his mother's death is his own fault, he can only muster the question, how did she die? Looking away, the father mutters, she died giving birth to you, and I lost all her help and comforts. I just want to quote from the back flap of the book, in which Bill says, the characters, eccentrics, and misadventures that make up these stories have always lived in me. Stories are a unique human aspect of our world. We are defined by the stories we tell, and as a writer, I feel obliged not only to retell them to my children and grandchildren, but to write them down, which is great. So welcome again, Bill Schubart, to Write the Book. It's great to have you here.
It's good to be here.
And I should mention, I've interviewed Bill twice before, and you can find those interviews on the podcast site. So I wonder if we could start today with you reading a couple of early parts of the book. There's a poem at the very beginning and then a prologue that's very setting-oriented. I thought those would be beautiful to start with.
Sure.
Okay,
great.
Happy
to. The poem at the beginning is called The Disappearing World. And it's actually a mixture of prose and poetry. But Lila and Theron do not imagine themselves poor, nor do they covet what they don't have. They are whole in themselves and on their land, and progress impinges little on their lives. Be cold. Forage and grow. Haul wood and stone. Go hungry. Use hand tools. Be bold. Raise children. Cure food. Walk without light. Keep animals. Grow old. Adore someone. Greet wildlife. Pay rapt attention. Forgive yourself and others.
Thank you. That was lovely. And then there's a prologue at the a couple pages later. I wonder if you could read that one as well.
Sure. Hardwood Flats doesn't appear on most local maps, but the name is used by locals to describe an unmapped area between Elmore, Woolcott, and Woodbury. It's a hardscrabble mix of isolated ponds, marshland, mixed second-growth hardwoods, and occasional stands of young evergreens. Walking in the woods, one can always hear running water somewhere. Much of the terrain seems to float on an island sea. Here and there, a few dirt roads, passable except in mud season, wind through the woods, feeding into corduroy logging roads and then tapering off into hunting trails and deer yards. Occasional year-round dwellings nestle here and there on the passable roads. Hunters or hikers will sometimes run across abandoned farmhouses moldering in clearings marked by their overgreen lilac bushes or unpruned apple trees. Farther in, they may encounter a tar paper deer camp with sun-bleached antler racks over a padlocked door.
Thank you. So that's the prologue from the new book by Bill Schubart, Lila and Theron. So I was curious about hardwood flats. So which of these places are real and which are fictional?
I don't think the term hardwood flats appears on a map, but that's what we always call that area.
Okay, so it is something that people say.
Yeah, it's almost a no man's land between Elmore, Woolcott, and Woodbury.
Yeah.
We used to, not that I was much of a hunter, but we used to hunt and fish in there and just, you know, play in those woods.
Yeah. So do you invent any setting in here, or is it all actual places?
It's all invented.
Okay, and the place names that you use are all real?
The place names I use are all real.
Okay,
yes.
But you've invented homes and properties,
yes,
and neighbors,
exactly,
and families.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Now, some of these characters existed in previous works that you wrote. Which characters have we seen before? And I have to apologize in advance. I haven't read the Lamoille stories, which
okay.
Yeah.
The genesis of this is interesting. My sister has lived in Morrisville all her life, and always with respect to privacy. She has been for many, many years the social services director at Copley Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So she hears and encounters everybody, especially in extremis.
Mm.
And she called me and told me one night, the book is dedicated to her.
Yeah,
she's such a wonderful storyteller.
Claire Hancock, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And she called me one night and she said, "Bill, I just can't believe the story I just heard." And she told me this story. And in a nutshell, it became one of the short stories in the Lamoille stories, mm, and became a lot of people's favorite story. And it was just about an old character. I mean, you've read. And,
right.
But the social worker goes up there and says, "You know, when you go out in the woods, do you leave your diabetic stroke wife here alone?" And he says, "No, I bring her with me." And he says, "Well, how do you do that? Because they're in their, you know, 80s. And he says, "Well, I just bring her in the bucket."
That was a real story.
That was a real story. And interestingly enough, the person on whom that story is based died 8 years ago.
Oh, wow.
I mean, this is not ancient Vermont.
Right, right.
And then, of course, you know, it's, "What do you mean you bring her in the bucket?"
Right, we should say what the bucket is.
Yeah, and then he says, "Well, over here, come over and take a look." And they walk over to his tractor, and in the bucket of the tractor, he's got a mattress and a quilt and some straps, and he puts her in there, and he brings her out with him,
mm-hmm,
while he's working.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the genesis story.
Yeah, yeah. And so were your characters, when you wrote that story, were they Lila and Theron?
The names are completely made up.
Oh.
And the story behind that is, I love the name Lila and I love the name Theron.
Yeah.
And my two nephews, Claire's grandchildren, are named Lila and Theron.
Oh.
So when I wrote the book, I wrote them. I think at the time one was maybe 8, and one was maybe 12 or 9 and 12. And I said, "Can I borrow your names for a book?" And of course, I asked their parents.
Yeah.
And everybody said, "Oh, that'd be fun." Yeah.
No, wait.
Lila is the older. Lila's probably now 14.
So she's your niece.
She's my niece.
Okay.
And Theron is my nephew.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Great. Well, I have a question. This is a sort of craft question, but I thought it was really interesting. So you have the poem, and then you have that prologue that is very setting-oriented.
Yeah.
And then chapter one starts with Thelma dying. This character named Thelma dies at 19, giving birth to a son. And the first paragraph is basically what I read in our introduction, where when the son first meets his father, he learns his mother's death is his fault and can only muster the question, how did she die? Looking away, the father mutters, she died giving birth to you, and I lost all her help and comforts. And then it backs up to Lionel Wright and Thelma Norris have been shy sweethearts since sixth grade. And then it goes into a little bit of that history. That was an interesting opening, and I just wondered if it took you a while to find the correct place to start this story.
It did. I mean, like most authors who have who have had good writing teachers, one learns very quickly that a person makes a decision about a book in the first 5 or 10 pages, and I always think about that when I start a book. You know, is am I going to say enough in the first few pages that so that someone cares enough to keep turning the pages?
Right.
And I'm not sure. I'm not as deliberative as an interviewer might want me to be. I often, it almost feels like I move in with some characters that I'm inventing, and then, you know, they become part of the driving narrative.
Right.
It sounds strange to say that.
No, I think I understand. So you sort of sometimes feel maybe a little bit like you are just sort of writing their lives as you experience it.
Yep. Yes.
Yeah. So here's a question along the same lines, a structural question. So this story, sort of the first half of the book, is about Theron. It's sort of his upbringing. It's his childhood. It's his time after he's in foster care, and then he goes back to live with his father. And I'm not going to give too much away, but they have a hard life on the farm. And half of the book is Theron getting to high school, basically.
Yep.
Lila, who has top billing on your title, we meet her literally almost to the page halfway into the book.
Right.
So again, how did it come to be that was how you were going to tell this story? Because, you know, the title makes it sound a little bit like this is a love story, and it is, but it's also the story of a life. It's a story of a town. It's sort of a story of America also. So,
I mean, it's a really interesting question, and I'm caught a bit off guard by it because the essential question that haunts Theron, and it haunts a lot of men, is, am I lovable?
Mm-hmm.
So, especially going through the incredible difficulties that he goes through, you know, with an alcoholic father.
Right.
And a child with an alcoholic father parents the child, ends up parenting the parent.
The parent, yeah.
And
he has no mother and no siblings.
Yeah. And there's always, there's two questions. There's the one of survival.
Right.
You know, if you're living in the middle of nowhere on a farm with your father and 28 cows that have to be milked every day and your father drinks, how do you survive? How do you keep the house warm? How do you keep the cows from dying because they haven't been milked? I mean, how do you have money for groceries? So living with that all the time, and then also living with somebody who has said to you, you're the reason I don't have someone to love me and care for me.
Right.
This boy grows up with, you know, would anybody ever love me?
Right.
And what does it mean to be loved? I mean, it's an alien concept. So when a young woman expresses interest in him much later on, he's struggling with this. What does she see in me?
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Although it's interesting, all those things you said about what his life is like and the work that he has to do to keep his father alive, to keep himself alive, to keep the farm alive, he's too busy to think too much about whether he's lovable until he meets somebody that he falls in love with, and then it's very clearly there, and we understand exactly why, right? It's interesting. I wanted to ask you about your upbringing in Vermont. I'm just curious how much of this is something that you're drawing on your own experience. Did you grow up on a farm or?
No. I'll try and just say it very concisely.
Okay.
My father died before I was born in the war. And my mother was sort of put into mourning until I was born.
Mm.
She was put in the Plaza Hotel, and a nurse was hired to be with her. I was born, and she basically went stir-crazy in this one room. And she one night just took off with me when I was, I think, a year and a half, maybe, on the Montrealer, the steam train. And she headed north because she'd gone to the Putney School as a young girl, and it's the only place she ever remembered being happy.
Oh, wow.
And she got off in Waterbury at random, took a bus that was there to Morrisville, which was then called a jitney.
Okay.
And rented a second-story apartment, and a couple of years later married a handsome French-Canadian ski instructor who I knew as my father.
Okay.
And so I grew up in a small community, and my stepfather first was a ski instructor and then worked in the transportation business in town, school buses, taxi driving, dry cleaning.
Yeah.
And we always had enough money to be okay. There was never a lot of extra money, but we were comfortable.
Right.
We were what you would call middle class.
Yeah. And had your mother been very wealthy from before when she was in New York?
She had come from a very wealthy family, but the wealth had not transferred.
Okay.
And that's a whole nother
story. I was just curious.
Yeah.
She starts out in New York and...
And she was troubled.
Yeah.
I mean, her brother was an MD.
Okay.
And the most effective way he could keep her at a distance was prescriptively.
Okay. So, all right.
But... We had a very interesting childhood. Then my half-brother and my half-sister were born. Half-sister is Claire. Half-brother is Michael, who I've been in partnership with all my life in various businesses, from Filo Records up through Resolution. And first jobs were on the farm right next to us, you know, helping with haying, letting the cows out in the morning and bringing them back in at night. And then I got a job working on a chainsaw crew for the state of Vermont, which is where I got very much into logging. And
so that's where you got a lot of the information that you used
for lot theory. Of it was very experiential.
Yeah, and actually it sounds like a lot of the book is very overlap with, I mean, you had a... It sounds like things went much better for you than it did for Theron.
And the other side of it was my grandmother in New York had lost her only son in the war.
Right.
And I was the only... thing left, so she was panicked that I was growing up, you know, in the sticks, not getting an education. So a deal was struck: twice a year I'd be put on a train by myself to New York from the age of 6 and spend a week or two with her. And that was a different world.
Yeah.
Just completely, we'd go to the Metropolitan Opera, the Metropolitan Museum, you know, Georgia O'Keeffe was in the apartment, and there were just all kinds of... And I'd lie in bed at night crying because I wanted to be home in Morrisville with my friends.
So. Chopping wood.
Yeah. So in retrospect, it was really difficult as a kid, but fascinating much later on in life.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's actually a good entry point to a question I had for you about an essay that you wrote called On Exigency... or Why I Wrote Lila and Theron. And this is a quote from the piece. Simply defined, exigency is that which is required. In a broader sense, exigency is the natural imperative to act on one's own or one's family's behalf to survive and thrive. The entitled culture is the opposite of a culture of exigency. That's me making it very simplified, but taking just that one sentence out. But I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that and why that inspired... or in what way that worked as an inspiration for Lila and Theron?
I mean, there are an awful lot of things that go into that, but I think the really basic thing is that so many of the kids and grown-ups that I knew and grew up with life was not easy. There weren't a lot of options. Mm-hmm. And the difficulty of growing up on a small hill farm, milking, you know, 25 to 35 cows and going through the four seasons, or making a living any way you could, that tempered people. Mm-hmm. It gave them a real strong sense of who they were and what they had to do to survive. And there was very little sense of victimhood. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that is, in my experience, that's been a fairly new construct societally. I mean, people talking about it, you know, requiring safe spaces in colleges and a lot of these kinds of things. I mean, my educational experience is that, you know, I had, in Morrisville, I had 5 or 10 teachers, and away at school, I had 5 or 10 teachers who didn't care about my self-esteem.
Yeah.
In the least.
Right.
All they cared about that I was learning. And they generally scared me. And I worked because I felt I had to.
Right.
And they didn't feel the need to inspire me.
Yeah.
You know.
I had a math teacher that used to shoot rubber bands at us when we got questions wrong. Can you imagine?
Yeah. I had an American history teacher who ended up being very famous. But he had a rubber stamp with a shovel on it. And if you turned in an essay that was, you know, full of
what
manure,
we can't say on the radio,
it'd be a rubber stamp all through it. But there's something about knowing what you have to do and doing it to first survive and hopefully thrive that really, I think, adds what we used to call character or anneals somebody. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing more and more of the phenomenon that Neil Postman wrote about in the mid-80s, amusing ourselves to death and feeling that we're victims of things beyond our control. And I don't mean to diminish that or to diminish poverty, because I differentiate between poverty and destitution, because I knew people who chose their lifestyle, and we would look at them and say, they're poor. But they didn't want to work at IBM. They wanted to be in the woods.
Right. You didn't want to really be in New York all the times that you were there, although I suspect at a certain point that became something different.
Yeah, I mean, I was, for all the luxury that New York represented, I wanted to be home.
Mm-hmm.
And my sense is that in poverty, in that kind of poverty, there's always the choice. You can go to work at IBM, or you can do something different. Whereas in destitution, there's no pathway out. And I saw both.
Right.
And I definitely saw both.
Yeah.
But to not understand poverty as a very nuanced term, I think, is a mistake.
Yeah. Okay. Great. There's an interesting aspect of this book, and I think it was probably clear in how I read that opening bit. The dialect, there's dialect very much reflected in this prose. And I wondered if you could talk about the decision to do that, to let us see the dialect.
It's really a great question, because when Howard Frank Mosher, who has been a wonderful mentor and friend, even though, as I said, we didn't know each other.
Yeah.
It was in print. And he read my first book, The Lemoyle Stories, and he said, I love these stories. They're really wonderful, but don't use dialect. Because although your dialect rings very true, he said to the person in Georgia, it's going to be an impediment to the narrative.
Right.
And, you know, I thought, he's really right. But then I thought, I'm never going to be successful enough so anyone in Georgia is ever going to read this. So I left all the dialogue in. I mean, the dialect in.
Yeah.
And the feedback I've gotten has not been that negative, or that it's a horrendous impediment. Although I did overwrite it so that it was really phonetic. And the copy editor pared it back. Okay. So that there was a balance between it being understood and also having the poetry that you want in dialect.
Yeah.
But I had to be moderated.
Yeah, but it's interesting because when you're reading a novel and maybe there's something a little bit unusual or something that the reader hasn't encountered before, it might at first sort of pop out and seem a little bit, but as you go, you just kind of get used to it. You know,
yeah.
I mean, as I was reading this book, the dialect became something that was just part of the read for
me.
Well,
that's good to hear.
Yeah.
I mean, because I've always, Howard Frank Mosher's advice has always rung in my head.
Well, now that we've mentioned Howard Frank Mosher, who passed away in January and was such an extraordinary writer, and he'd been on the show, and just a lovely man. So I want to read his blurb. May I? So he blurbed this book. He said, "I have long considered Bill Schubart to be the wisest columnist in America. The same wisdom, deep life experience, and empathy come shining through on every page of his new novel, Lila and Theron, full of joy, sadness, humor, and insight. Lila and Theron is a clear-eyed celebration of our almost boundless capacity, despite all our human frailties, to love both one another and the place we call home. Over the years, I have known many true and good country people like Lila and Theron, whom I have been proud and honored to call my friends. This is a beautiful book." So, what a great blurb.
I mean, that's, of course, what a writer lives for.
Exactly.
You know, people ask all the time, you know, why do you write? Why do you write? When somebody says, "I read your book and it meant something to me," that's really what you live for.
Exactly. And I want to just say something about one of the things that he said, which is, "I've known many true and good country people like Lila and Theron." And those are good characters. Like, they are good people. They're good. But one of the characters in this book that's less clearly good or bad is Theron's father, mm-hmm. Lionel. And I really loved how you wrote him. And part of what I loved about it is that there are moments of tenderness that come through from him. There are moments where you can see who he might have been,
yeah,
if he had been stronger, if he had been in a different circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved that you didn't just create him as a bad guy, you know, mm-hmm. like as the terrible father who drinks too much and beats his son or something. You know, there's nuance there, there's subtlety. And, you know, one of the scenes that comes to mind, which I don't have marked in my pages, but Theron finds a cat, a kitten. And, you know, at first I'm like, oh, his father's never going to let him keep this cat. But he did, and he helped him feed him. And I thought that was just a really tender scene, and it made me feel so much better because I wanted there to be some redeeming quality to this father that mm-hmm. would make the son, you know, feel some allegiance to him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which he does. You know?
Well, I think the big risk that I took with Lionel was where he would find his tenderness.
Mm-hmm.
And you know where he goes, and men never talk about it, but mm-hmm. Most men have a desire for tenderness.
Mm-hmm.
They portray, you know, all the macho stuff and
right.
all the I'm fine and all, you
right.
know, all this stuff, but they never forget how their mother treated them.
Yeah.
And that desire for tenderness persists. And I thought to myself, where is Lionel going to go for this? And of course, he goes to this one cow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not sexual at all.
No, but it was interesting because there was also a parallel between Theron and his cat. That's where he gets his that's where he gets his kindness and his father goes to this cow.
Yeah.
And sits in her stall and talks to her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And lies his head on her udder, and I don't know if you've ever felt the very gentle fur on a cow's udder.
Okay, no.
It's just,
I have not.
It's just very, you know, it's
yeah.
very soft
yeah.
and wonderful.
I used to take my kids to the Shelburne Farms children's barn, and they would get to milk the cows,
yes.
but I myself have never done it.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to just interrupt our conversation
sure.
for a second to say you are listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. This is an interview with Vermont author Bill Schubart, and we are streaming on 99.3 WBTV.org. You wrote the book in the present tense.
I did.
Is that your most comfortable place, or is that just how this story felt like it needed to be told?
It's my least comfortable place.
Oh, interesting. Wow.
I've only done it twice. Once was here, and then I also did it in a novel, the I Am Baby novel, which is about the blind street singer who I knew very well.
Mm.
And I also, which I just felt so arrogant when I started out, I wrote it in first person present.
I Am Baby?
I Am Baby.
Yeah.
So I, you know, this...
Street.
As I just learned, cisgendered white... I had to call my daughter. I said, somebody just called me a cisgendered white male. What did they mean? And she explained it to me.
Well, let's explain it. Go ahead.
Well, I'm not sure I fully understand. It's basically you are what you look like.
Okay.
So if I'm a cisgendered, you know, white male of middle class, when you look at me, that's what you'd assume I am.
Okay. All right.
So, anyway, you know, I wrote the voice of a woman from desperate poverty, blinded at birth by a drunken doctor, through her whole life, singing in the streets.
Of New York?
New York.
Yeah, okay.
In fact, when people who read the book who live in New York remembered her.
Hmm.
She used to sing outside of Bloomingdale's.
Hmm.
And we brought her up to Vermont and recorded. Her songs were so unusual.
Oh, wow.
We did an album of her, and we brailled it.
Huh. Oh, that's cool.
But anyway.
Was that Mount Philo Records?
Philo Records, yeah.
Oh, not Mount Philo. Philo.
No, just Philo Records.
Okay.
But that was another huge risk.
Yeah.
Because if you don't get it right, you get it really wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
And writing in the present is hard because... your natural instinct is to drop back. So I had to constantly go back and make sure that I was staying in the present. And even then, the proofreader would pick up, or the copy editor would pick up, lapses.
Well, it can be hard, too, when you're writing the present tense, because there is backstory, and then what do you do with that, and where do you go? And, yep. There are ways to do it, but you can trip yourself up, right? So
exactly.
If you go into your backstory and you do a little past tense for a paragraph, and then you're back, and you're like, oh, no, I've done three new chapters, and they're all in the past tense.
Well, you have to really understand the pluperfect, the perfect, and the imperfect
right.
to write in the present.
Exactly, right. let's see. So I thought it was interesting, as I said, the first half of the book is Theron's childhood and upbringing. It's not exactly written only in his point of view, but we are very close to his narrative. We understand how he feels and what he thinks. And I thought you did a really nice job when he's a little boy. He's 6 years old, and it's interesting to see him watching his father and processing his behavior. And we already know his father's an alcoholic or mm-hmm. becoming one. He doesn't know that, or he doesn't understand it, but it's interesting for us as readers to see his perspective. Did you have to temper that at all to get it just right?
No, I had to, in this book, because there were so many, I don't know what to call them, temporal inversions, or, you know, I did really take risks, both in chronology and tense.
Mm-hmm.
I would, whenever I'd sit down to write, I'd go back and read the prior chapter.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
And even then, I made mistakes.
Yeah.
You know, that either I would find or the editor would find.
Okay.
But the other thing I struggle with as a writer is continuity.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? You know, on page 9, the cat is a tiger. And, you know, on page 38... he's turned
into a tabby. Well, that's what editors help with.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right. let's talk a little bit about the way that this book is a story of place. It's a story of not just the woods or a town, also the nation to some extent, because the war comes into it too. And also just a community. It's a story of a community. Neighbors are very important in this story. Mm-hmm. Family is very important in the story. I loved the uncle, Adrian. How did you organize this so that you were... I mean, it's just very sweeping. There's a lot of... this is a small book, and it has a lot going on.
You know, you've asked me the first question I don't really know how to answer. I mean, I wanted Lila's backstory. Right. And as you say, we don't even talk about Lila until we're halfway through
the book.
That's
right, yeah.
And Lila's backstory is as formative of her, even though it's somewhat truncated compared to her Theron's, but it informs who she is.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the stories of the log runs and, you know, how her father died and so on and so forth. I think it just, even though it's shorter, it's every bit as dramatic and important as Theron's backstory.
Mm-hmm.
She's clearly a more self-knowing person.
Mm-hmm.
She has... she can be more socially direct than Theron. I mean, Theron is completely confused as to why anybody would love him.
Yeah, yeah.
And I won't give anything away, but, you know, she knows more who she is.
Right. Well, I think one other thing that you do really well is that you go into a certain amount of detail on a smaller sort of... what's the word I want to say? You know, like there's a great deal of detail about certain aspects of farm life, for example, that I just loved. There's this wonderful moment where we learn how Lionel builds a fire, for example, right? So there's a lot of detail about how he's actually making the logs into kind of a pyramid and how he goes about. But then when it comes to something like the war, there are certain sections that are very much just sort of like, this is what happened.
Yeah.
You know, Uncle Adrian went to war, and this is what happened, mm-hmm. and, you know. And we know a lot about the war, you know.
Yeah.
Anybody who's reading this book already has quite a lot of information about the war. But we don't necessarily know how they built a fire in the woods.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I remember as a kid, the people who went off to the Korean War...
Mm.
We didn't know anything about the Korean War.
No, not until MASH.
All we knew is that people died.
Yeah.
Or came back mutilated.
Right.
Or came back psychologically damaged.
Yes.
So that's all I was going to say about Uncle Adrian.
Right.
Is what would have been perceived in the community.
Exactly. That's right.
You know?
That's right. It's a bit of a mystery what happened to Uncle Adrian.
I mean,
yes.
You know, the whole phenomenon of him reading the war poets.
Right.
I didn't need to go deep on that.
Right.
But the minute you talk about the war poets, you begin to understand that there were people who were so damaged
mm-hmm.
by the fact that World War I never made any sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
To anybody.
That's interesting. So there were details that I had never heard of before, and I love. Like, what's a vermifuge tablet?
A what?
Vermifuge?
A vermifuge.
Yeah.
That's so, one of those words that we learned as kids.
It's a tablet for parasites?
Worms.
You got worms.
Verm is worms.
Right.
And fuge is get rid, you know,
okay.
Flea.
Okay.
And we would be tested for worms in grade school because... Not very little milk. The milk we got in school was pasteurized, but a lot of the farm kids, there was
raw milk.
Raw milk.
Right. That's where the worms... So
and
I didn't understand
get
where
the worms.
Oh.
The worms are completely harmless. They're
right.
just, you know, living inside and doing okay. But we would be tested.
And then you'd have to take these tablets.
For lice. And if you had worms, then you'd take a tablet and the worms would come out.
It would take care of it.
Yeah.
Just, okay. Then the other one that I had never heard, and I just loved it, was a Boston marriage.
Oh, yeah.
I never heard that term, which seems to be a polite way of referring, in the times it was polite because I'm sure it was not very popular, to lesbian relationships.
Yeah.
Right? That was great.
Well, it's a term I actually heard later in life.
Yeah.
But then going back in and talking to some of the older people in town, they did know the term. And it was remarkably, you know, for all the Sturm und Drang we have now about, you know, cross-dressing and gender identities and how it's become such a... There was a lot of that when we were kids.
Mm-hmm.
But not everybody felt the need to worry about it or obsess about it. There really was a live and let live I mean, one of the most legendary math teachers that I went to school with lived with another woman for years, and they were in a Boston marriage, and you know, what they did was their business.
Yeah.
And then we had Crazy Chase, who was everyone. I mean, he's legendary, and Con Hogan's been doing a book on him, and someone did a musical on him. I would run across him walking home, and he was a cross-dresser. Big, burly guy like me with hairy legs and, you know, rolled-up nylon stockings and a pillbox hat and a purse.
And that was just who he was.
That's who he was.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay, great. Was there any area that required a lot of research, or did you sort of know your subject matter pretty well?
The whole area around the guys coming back from World War I trying to get the money that had been promised them.
Right, I'd never heard too much about that.
Yeah.
So that, Uncle Adrian's.
That I actually had to look up. I knew a little bit about it, but the more I read about it, the more of an interesting tragedy it became.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. I want to just mention Lila a little bit. She is quite an important part of the book, but she's in the second half of the book. I loved that their first date is a sugar on snow party, complete with the required pickles. Mm-hmm. Did you ever do sugaring when you were a kid? Did your family do sugaring?
We went, you know, every spring we would go. And there'd be, you know, a horse-drawn sledge hauling people up into the woods.
Yeah.
And the two things that were always there were very sour pickles and black coffee. And you were told never to drink water. Hmm. Because if you drank water to get the sweetness out of your mouth, you'd fill up with water so quick. I mean, you just go back and forth between the sugar and the water.
Right.
And if you felt like you'd had too much sugar, you ate a sour pickle.
Okay.
Then you could go have more sugar.
Love that. Let's talk a little bit about how this became a book. Mm-hmm. So when did you write this?
I finished it probably in the spring of last year.
Mm-hmm.
And finishing means the manuscript is done. Do you know what I mean?
Actually, a full draft.
Finishing the draft that you're comfortable with,
right?
Maybe 6-8 months before that. And then I have a process which I go through. I literally hire 3 critical readers.
Okay.
They're not editors. And I don't pay them a lot of money, but I pay for their time.
Right.
And what I ask of them is, read this book. Don't be a copy editor. Don't be a literary editor. I want one page of what works, what doesn't work, what characters need more development, anything you see that needs my attention. Then I rewrite again. Then it goes to a literary editor who does that at a much higher level.
And in this case, that was Lynn Stone?
Yes.
Okay.
Then it goes to a copy editor. And I have a wonderful copy editor who did not do this book. The publisher chose the copy editor for this. But the woman I use lives in Tunbridge. Her name is Ruth Sylvester. And she is fabulous because as a copy editor, I'll get something back and she'll say, "What are you talking about? McCullough never made a 2240 chainsaw. You're talking about the McCullough 240. Or, you know, the John Deere tractor you're talking about. There were none of those in New England."
So she's the perfect copy editor for you.
Yeah. And she even knows dialect, which is wonderful.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you always used to publish through Magic Hill Press, which was your press, correct?
Well, the first book, The Lamoille Stories, came out with White River Press, which is what we now call an assist publisher.
Okay.
You're sharing the cost of development, and you're doing your own, but they're overseeing the distribution.
Okay.
And they did a very good job, and they did everything they said they would do.
Mm-hmm.
I think they probably sold 5,000 or 6,000 copies.
Mm-hmm.
And then it began to slow down, and I said, you know, can I have the rights back? And they said, sure. And so I brought them back and republished it under Magic Hill, my own imprint. And then everything subsequently. So I am a self-published writer,
mm-hmm.
and was thoroughly planning to do the same with this until this friend of mine you know, said, "So what are you writing?" And I said, "Well, send it to me," and the rest is history.
And we should say this friend of yours was an editor. He was an editor at Random House?
No, he was actually, he worked for us at Philo Records many, many years ago.
Right.
And then he went into publishing.
But he was in the publishing industry.
Right. He was at Ballantine. He was CFO of Ballantine and Random House.
Okay.
And then bought the distribution arm of Random House and ran CDS, which was extremely successful.
Okay.
Then he sold that to Perseus Books. But he's always been involved in publishing.
Mm-hmm.
And he's tough. He's not, you know, this was not based on any knowledge of one another or friendship.
He just
fell in love with the manuscript.
And is this the first book by Charles Michael Publishing?
I don't think so.
No.
Okay. I'm not sure. I'd have to
But it's a fairly
ask.
New press.
There, yes, it is. It's a new imprint, and they're handled by Simon & Schuster.
Okay. All right. Great. Well, that's fun to hear about because... you know, people try to figure out, what am I going to do with my book? And it seems like there are so many options now, which on the one hand is a good thing. On the other hand, we're always questioning ourselves, you know, which is the right path for me.
Right. And it's hard because there are people of great capability and integrity at every end of the publishing spectrum.
Right.
I mean, Vanity Publishing still exists. Then there's traditional publishing.
Mm-hmm.
They both changed radically. But that spectrum, which used to be sort of bipolar, now is all filled out with different kinds of publishers in between.
Right.
Some are terrific. And there are people who I think might, if they were willing to work for the next 5 years, get an agent and get a traditional publishing, but who want to move more quickly and can go to with an assist publisher and get distribution and get exactly what they need done.
Right. Okay. I want to ask you what you're writing now. Are you working on something new?
I'm not going to say I've finished, but I finished the first draft of a new novel, again, based on a lot of experience. And it's about a young boy growing up in New England in a Catholic community who is so uncomfortable with the onset of teenage sexuality. He doesn't embrace it. He finds it scary, as many kids do.
Mm-hmm.
He decides at 12 years old to become a Catholic priest.
Mm, interesting.
And to make a long story short, by the time he's in his 60s, he's a complete apostate.
Yeah.
He doesn't like the church.
Yeah.
But he's so enamored, not enamored, he's so, it means so much to him caring for people, that he stays, and he learns his whole understanding of life is through the screen of a confessional.
Oh, interesting.
As a young priest, he didn't know these sins existed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's hearing all the stuff that he's never lived, so it's vicarious.
And what's the time period and what's the setting?
Time period is probably 1930 to 1990.
Okay. And is it Vermont?
Yeah, it starts in Massachusetts and then New Hampshire and then Vermont.
Okay, great.
And I had three very good friends who were priests.
Oh, all right. From school or?
No, really one from my childhood, two from my childhood. And they were totally different. And one from when I went away for an eating disorder.
Mm.
This was an 800-pound priest who came in on a gurney.
You wrote about that
in your
story collection, Fat People.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I always ask, because writers are such voracious readers, if you've read anything lately that you would recommend to listeners.
I'll tell you, the most wonderful thing that I've read recently is the Neapolitan novels.
Oh, yeah.
Elena Ferrante.
Yes.
I read the first one out of curiosity and then just shot through all four of them.
Yeah.
And...
Are there four or are there more than four?
I think there are just four.
Okay.
I think there are just four. I mean, I read four, and I think that's it, but I'm not sure.
Okay. I read one, so I can't say for
sure. But I am so intrigued by people's ability to write the voices of women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jim Harrison used to be very good as a man writing in a woman's voice.
Mm-hmm.
But this reminded me of Proust.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just the characterization of real human relationships.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, great. And then my last question is just, your work often has a lot of history in it, and it's also just very character-driven. So I wonder if you have any advice, and this may or may not be anything you've actually thought about consciously before, but if you have advice for writers on imbuing history with life in a narrative, like bringing life to history in a narrative.
I mean, I think... It's the cliche that you always hear from writing teachers, and that is write what you know.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to read history and understand it vicariously through reading and then try and imbue it, again, imbue it with stuff that you know experientially.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that's so important. I mean, I a friend, Tobin Anderson, who...
He was my guest 2 weeks ago.
Was he?
Yeah.
Tobin and I serve on the same board together.
Okay. He wrote a new graphic novel. It's awesome.
About the Shostakovich Seventh Symphony
and
the Siege of Leningrad. I mean, I've read two or three books on the Siege of Leningrad. Leningrad.
Yeah.
Leningrad.
Yeah.
And to approach it from the Shostakovich Seventh Symphony.
Yeah.
So he wrote what he knew.
Yeah.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, that's a great example. My interview with him was about Yvain. He's got a new graphic novel called Yvain, and it's from the King Arthur legends.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's really good.
Great.
All right, so thank you so much, Bill. I'm going to give a little bit of a closing here, and then we're going to put some music on for a minute.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
It was really fun, and I want to just mention again, the name of the book is Lila and Theron. It's a novel by Bill Schubart, published by Charles Michael Publishing. And you can read more about Bill Schubart's work at schubart.com. Is that correct? SCHUBART.com. In offering this week's Write the Book prompt, I've decided to share another quote from Bill's essay on exigency. Consider the following sentences and then write about whatever might come to you as a result. This is a quote from Bill Schubart. There is an intrinsic self-reliance in those who see life's exigencies as challenges to be overcome. Development in the person who feels victimized and overlooked by life becomes stunted, since he is always looking outside himself for someone or something to blame. So I'm going to put those sentences up on the podcast site so that you can read them and really think about them and then see if that takes you somewhere with your work this week. Good luck in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And then, of course, you can stream the show live each week at 99.3 WBTV.org. That's every Monday at 3. The second hour typically features reruns and sometimes other new content. So stream the show live. When we're broadcasting, it will be on 99.3 FM, and we will be sure to let you know. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And as I say every week, if you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont. Have a great week.